in the middle of chapter 19. And last time we read through the first paragraph, talking about kind of the history of the law, God giving a law to Adam, remember? A very specific commandment that he didn't give to everybody else, but he gave the moral law all the way back there as well. So that the Ten Commandments that we normally talk about them have their roots going back to the very beginning, not on Mount Sinai. Moses didn't make up the Ten Commandments. It's always been wrong to commit adultery. Remember we talked about that? And, you know, it's called the great sin in the ancient world. I think it's Genesis 12, when Abraham, the second half of it, when Abraham goes down into Egypt, and the Pharaoh's there, and Pharaoh's like, you almost made me commit the great sin because you told me that she was your sister. So the Pharaoh knew about adultery being wrong. How could he possibly know that? Moses wouldn't be born for hundreds of years. Okay, because it's always been wrong. That's why. So the law, the moral law has its roots there. So now we come to paragraph 2. And let's kind of go over this again. The same law that was first written in the heart of man continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness after the fall, and was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments and written in 2 tables. The first 4 containing our duty to God, and the other 6 our duty to man. I don't know if these pens work because I didn't check them out. But well, let's just write these kind of in the normal way of thinking about the commandments. So that lesson I did, I don't know, a year ago or whatever, take that out of your mind. We're just going to do the normal way of thinking about it. What's the first commandment? Come on, guys.
I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, so do not have no gods.
Yeah, okay, so we're going to go with the typical Protestant first commandment. Because some people think it's the prologue.
I am the Lord your God, who brought you out.
What it's basically, we usually think of it as this, right? No gods before. Before God. What's the second one?
No images.
Okay, we'll just call it no images. What's the third one?
Don't take the name in vain.
The name? What's the fourth one?
Sabbath.
What's the fifth one?
Parents.
What's the sixth one? What's the seventh one? What's the eighth one? Okay. What's the ninth one?
False.
Yeah, well, I'm going to put false witness because I don't like the word lying there. Because it's specific. Lying is kind of a bigger category. False witness is more of a courtroom thing. And every once in a while, it is okay to lie. You remember that with Moses, for example, and the people that hit him? What's the tenth one?
Covetousness.
Okay, so you can see that you have 4 traditionally thinking and 6 over here with the way that we break them up. Okay? So, let's go back and read this a little bit more closely. This law is what it's saying. This law was written on the heart of man, okay, Adam, at the beginning. And it continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness after the fall. Is there anything wrong with these commandments? Is there a fault with the commandment? Is there something terrible about these commandments? No, Paul says the law is holy, righteous, and good in Romans 7. I was talking with Ed earlier about you know, a lot of people are like, how do you interpret Romans 7? Who's he talking about? What law is he talking about? Well, when I was first kind of going through Romans very seriously, I had in my head Adam the whole time. Most people don't have that. They might have Paul, they might have Israel. I had Adam in my head. I could not get Adam out of my head. The commandment is holy, righteous, and good. What commandment? Well, Paul takes coveting in that case. He takes the 10th commandment, which in some ways, if you break this, it's because
If you break in this, it's because you've done something in one of the other categories that you're not supposed to do. If you commit adultery, what have you done? You've coveted somebody else's wife. If you're stealing something, what have you done? You've coveted somebody else's possessions. Coveting, like, sums them all up. And so that's one of the reasons why I think he picks coveting there. But he doesn't find fault with the law. And a lot of people find fault with the law. The law is bad. It's not bad.
What if he commits adultery with a single woman?
Well, that would just be fornication, but it's still a problem. She didn't belong to him yet. Just messing around with me, John. Come on now. Okay? So, it's saying that these commands, as they're written here, were written in our heart, and they are a rule of righteousness after the fall. You learn this in the fourth chapter of Genesis, don't you? What did Cain do to his brother? He killed him. Well, how could he possibly know it was wrong to kill somebody like that, to murder him, if it wasn't wrong in his heart? And God confronts him on it, you know? And Cain tries to deny that he has any responsibility. Am I my brother's keeper? He's lying there on top of it, right? He knows exactly where his brother is. He knows wrong to kill his brother, but he did it anyway. Because the laws are on his heart. And every person that's ever lived after that, the law continues to be a perfect rule of righteousness. Now, this law was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments. So there's our 10. God came down, and the first time that it was delivered, God himself wrote the commandments with his own finger. Angel of the Lord, in my opinion, is the one who did that. And Moses is up there, and he receives the law from God. Now, in the Ten Commandments, we break them into these two tables. So you've got one table here. I should put it this way, shouldn't I? I should put four here, and I should put six here, and then I should put table one, and then table two. So there's your two tables. That's what it's talking about when it talks about the two tables. Okay? The first four are duty to God. The last six are our duty to man. Okay? Now, I don't know if now's the right time to do this or not. I kind of think that it is. The way that God gave the commandments is mostly, in my opinion, the moral law that goes back to the beginning. However, there are a couple of lengthy commands in the ten, aren't there? I believe that the lengthiness of those, and in fact, one of them even changes between Exodus and Deuteronomy. And that would be the Sabbath commandment. In Exodus, you are to keep the Sabbath. Why? Because on the seventh day, God rested. However, in Deuteronomy, the fourth commandment, has a very different reason why you're to keep it. Do you remember what it is? Yeah, because I brought you out of Egypt. Now, I brought you out of Egypt, it was not written on the heart of Cain. Okay? So using that as an example, my view is that the Ten Commandments given to Moses as they were given to Moses were specific covenantal commands given to the nation of Israel. Now that does not mean that the other nations were not held accountable for the Ten Commandments. It simply means in this form, Israel was to keep the Ten Commandments. It was their peculiar covenant. So don't create an either-or with this. That either nobody had the Ten Commandments beforehand, or somehow Cain was obligated to keep the Sabbath because God brought him out of Egypt. Neither of those things are true. All right? So there is a peculiar way of thinking about the Ten that is for Israel. And there is a general way of thinking about the same ten that is for all people. Does that make sense to you? I think that's really important because this debate just gets it just gets so thorny, and the weeds grow so high about the relationship of the law to the New Testament, the law of Moses to the New Testament. I'm going to try and clarify some of that as we go along, what we mean by the law of Moses. Just for now, I just want you to think about God gave to Moses the Ten Commandments, and that those commandments existed beforehand. And if they existed beforehand, brothers and sisters, the Ten Commandments exist after Moses too. This is not something that started with Sinai and ends with the crucifixion of Jesus. Nor is it there's a Stephen Wright joke I always tell with this. He goes, I woke up in the morning and I found that everything in my house had been stolen that last night and replaced with an exact replica. Come on now. You got to think about that a little bit. Everything had been stolen and replaced with an exact replica? Now that's funny.
Was that the first time it was written down?
Well, we don't know. Don't know the answer to that. I mean, they certainly had written out you should not commit adultery long before Moses ever came along. And also murder laws. We know that. Ceremonial laws as well. In this form, that's the way that first time that they had been written like that. Okay? Now, the reason I say that about the Stephen Wright joke is because some people have, that's my view of the way they think about the law of Moses with the New Testament. Well, the Old Testament, the New Covenant has come and obliterated all Ten Commandments, but the New Testament comes along and rewrites nine of them as an exact replica. What? It's just about as funny as a Stephen Wright joke, I think, right? Like, that makes no sense. What are you talking about? It has always been wrong to murder, and it's always going to be wrong to murder. That doesn't change. God doesn't need to rewrite it, to obliterate it and then rewrite it. It's enough. In fact, Jesus said, I came not to abolish the law. Not one jot or tittle will pass away. Right? So, you don't want to have that thought in your head. With the Ten Commandments, these are eternal moral principles for all men at all times. And I, like I said last time, I believe that that includes Sabbath, the idea of rest. And Matt?
With that,
doesn't apply, right?
It's not required. And the response to that is, how did Paul understand that when he would say something like, what it is to covet? He didn't take them as individual things. It was a set. He called it the royal law.
Yeah, that's good.
All these things that are... So just because the Bible doesn't apply out state certain things explicitly, we can know what Paul was saying. And with the Sabbath, big confusion between in the intertestamental period with Judaism and Christianity, where things are starting to transition. And is the Lord's Day, the Sabbath? I would say it's always been the Sabbath has always been the Lord's Day, and the Lord's Day is the Sabbath. It's just for thousands of years that was associated with Jewish tradition. So when they say that, there needs to be a transition to separate that from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant that clearly defined it. flow to it that is coherent, that we can read, and I think a lot of your teaching and preaching has been helping draw that out. It doesn't have to say, we can mark through progressive, the redemptive history, and the Lord's Day is specifically a special day, and it's important, and God's law is important.
Yep, we will come to Sabbath more. There's a whole chapter that kind of, well, at least a couple paragraphs that deal with Sabbath later. You guys won't be here for that, but just the two little short comments on that is, one is, I actually think that the ancient pagans knew more about seventh-day Sabbath than we give them credit for.
Yeah.
Seventh-day Sabbath, pagans. I think there's something encoded in creation, the cycles, and I also think that they could have certainly remembered history and stuff like that. We know seven was big with them with regard to worship. So, and the second one, comment about Sabbath and the first day, just to say, and we'll just to tease you for the coming chapter, there are first day Sabbaths in the Old Testament. It's not just seventh day. So that's something we'll get to. Yeah, Dory.
Yeah, I can't help but think about Hebrews and the discussion there about rest and entering into God's rest, which is what the Sabbath is rest. And it's not limited to a day, but it's something that you do. You cease from your own work.
Yeah.
So that's like an internal thing. You cease from trying to, appropriate salvation by following the law, and you cease from all your own trying and all of that, and rely on God. So that's an internal rest rather than like an outside observable day of the week kind of rest.
Yeah, so let's think of it. Think of the day of the week as almost typological of the eternal rest. But we still need the type. So I'm just thinking of this prayer without ceasing. Okay, so the Bible says pray without ceasing. Does that mean, therefore, I give up actually specifically praying and setting aside some period of time to pray for things? No, that would be ridiculous to think that. In the same way, we need typological Sabbath so that we can understand with our bodies what it is that, spiritually speaking, is already true, if that makes sense. And so that we can help conform the rest of our lives to what that is modeled on that one day. And that's not something that we grow out of just because we become Christians. Yeah, Rick.
Two questions. The first is, do you think that Romans 2 on how the law is written on every man is a reflection of the pagan keeping
of 100%. 1,000,000%. Yeah, absolutely.
Secondly, I asked a question last week at 11:46, and you said that's a good question. Can I ask you again? I don't want to interrupt you.
I totally forgot what your question was and didn't look it up.
It has to do with this. Let me read this. Just therefore, death just through one man, sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sin. Here's the question, next verse.
Right.
For until the law,
right,
sin was in the world. But sin is not imputed where there's no law. Other translations say counted. So we're talking about the men between Adam and Moses died because sin is the culprit. Sin is the killer. But it said that it's not counted, imputed. That's a big word because we have Christ's righteousness imputed to us. What's the context of what the Word of God is saying here? The law is not imputed. It looks like it's saying between Adam and Moses, everybody who lived didn't have law imputed to them. It wasn't charged with them, and we know we're charged
right
with Adam's. Can you just comment on that?
Yeah, so I think it's talking more of it's tough. Most people, first of all, do take the view that he's talking about the law being Sinai. Okay? I don't know that this is necessarily true, but it's the most used people's view. And then before the law, which would mean from Adam to Moses.
Yeah.
Now, he kind of almost says that, you know, in that verse. When you come down to read the end of the passage there, right? Now, verse 20, now the law came to increase the trespass, but where sin
increase, grace to increase all the more. So sin reigned in death, grace also might reign through righteousness, leading to eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. So sin is not imputed to the people's account because there's no law. His point is death still reigned even though he was not there with a written law saying, you have broken this written law. You still knew that it was wrong. It was written on your heart. Therefore, you die. And then his point is to make this comparison between the first Adam and what he brought, and the second Adam, which is what he brought. It's a very, very complicated passage. But
because for years, I couldn't grasp imputed righteousness, I think. That whole concept of God making Adam in his image, and then this blockbuster, and then Adam had a son in his image, really threw the light on it, that we were born dead in Adam's fallen state. That didn't hit me for 7-8 years after my conversion. And when it did, everything started to get a little straighter about imputed grace, righteousness, and so forth. Our works flowed from our conversion, our new heart, and so anyway, I go on, but I just wanted to know, because that's what I said. That's mm-hmm. what I answered.
Let's keep going here, because I want this conversation to be in the same moment so that we don't forget as we're putting this together. And we have about 15 minutes left. So this is number 3. Besides this law, that's this up here, commonly called the moral law. So this is what we call moral. God was pleased to give to the people of Israel ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, his actions, his sufferings, his benefits, and partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws being appointed only for the time of Reformation are by Jesus Christ, the true Messiah, the only lawgiver who was furnished with the power of the Father, for that end, abrogated and taken away. Now, I just want to, for the moment, I just want to talk about a kind of law that differs from moral law. It's called ceremonial law. That's what this is talking about. Ceremonial laws. Now, before we get into the paragraph, look at paragraph 4. To them, he also gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging them now by virtue of that institution, their general equity only being of modern use.
Moral.
Oh, I have a mistypo there. Only being of moral use. Except I didn't type that. So that's on our website. Does yours say moral? I got to know that because that's a typo on our website. Okay, interesting. Yeah, so our website has that typo there. I actually like modern use.
Well, and that's kind of what happens today.
But moral use, yeah.
Presidency and the governor.
Right, right.
Come in and change stuff.
Yeah. So there's a second category of law that's not moral law, and that's called judicial law. Okay? Or you could call it civil law. Okay? So you've got civil law and judicial law that are different category from moral law. We've talked about moral law here. Now we're going to talk about civil laws and ceremonial laws. What are these? How are we to think about them? When we think about the law of God, you have to make category distinctions in your head. If everything is just law, and you say the law has been abrogated in the New Testament, then you're going to come to these conclusions that the Ten Commandments are gone. But if there are distinctions in law, then you don't necessarily have to come to that conclusion. We've already seen why you shouldn't come to that conclusion in paragraph 2. Now let's come to paragraphs 3 and 4 and try and understand what they're talking about with regard to how does ceremonial law, how did it apply then? What was its purpose? How does it apply today? If at all. And then we'll do the same thing with civil law. Okay, so the moral law was there in the Ten Commandments. And God was pleased to give to the people of Israel ceremonial laws. Now, this is the same kind of an idea as what he did in paragraph one, where he gives to Adam a specific law. Okay, same idea. These ceremonial laws are very specific to the people of Israel. Now, first caveat, that doesn't mean other people didn't have ceremonial laws. And in fact, the way that, I don't know if this is right or not, but this is the way I think about it. If you think about this as table one and our duty to God, who are ceremonial laws directed towards? Okay, and if you think about civil laws, and if you think about table two, our duty to man, who are civil laws directed towards?
Man.
And so I think of ceremonial law, and our confession kind of hints at this. Ceremonial law is essentially case law. You know what case law is? Somebody give me a definition of case law.
It's judicial decisions that have been made previously that can be relied upon to interpret current situations.
And what are they rooted on? Aren't they rooted? They're rooted in some kind of a more general kind of a law. So in our Constitution, it would be the Ten Commandment equivalent would be the Bill of Rights. And the case law would be judicial decisions that have come upon, being based upon those Bill of Rights in specific instances. So ceremonial law, I kind of think, is case law of the first four commandments brought into corporate worship, individual worship, how we're to go and approach God, and so on. Now, this doesn't work 100% of the time, but it's been helpful for me to think about it. Ceremonial law, then, would be case law of the second table and how we're to treat our man. So you think about an example I like to give is there's a law in the Old Testament that says you're supposed to put a fence on your roof. Well, if you're a theonomist, you know, a hardcore theonomist, you say everybody should put fences on the roof today because you're not making category distinctions. I'm like, no, I don't think so. That's a case law. What was the purpose of putting a fence on your roof? Anybody want to take a guess?
The husband that was sitting up there because his wife was in the house would fall off.
And die, right? So in other words, it was for safety. And if you wanted to put it specifically, I would think that it would have in mind case law of murder.
Yeah.
That's the function of it. This is why, you know, you go to the top of a skyscraper and you're not going to be allowed to walk out there and just walk off the edge of the thing. You're going to put walls around it. It's for that reason. It's not because the civil law itself is like some sort of an untouchable eternal principle. It's that it is coming out of an eternal principle that is then directed to a specific situation. Ceremonial law would be the exact same thing. Now, let's look at what the ceremonial law's purpose was and why it is that it comes to this conclusion that for that end, it's abrogated and taken away. So let's look at this. Okay, ceremonial laws, they contain several typical ordinances. Now, what does the word typical mean there? Does it mean common, ordinary? No, it means type and shadow. In other words, the ceremonial law there, it was prefiguring something. Right? What's it prefiguring? Well, it's doing several things. It's prefiguring partly of worship. How is it that, and put it in, I'll be Platonic, but I'm not going to be Platonic, I'm going to be Hebrewic from the book of Hebrews, because Hebrews does this. The earthly tabernacle is a pattern of the one in heaven. And so if there are ceremonial laws that are given to in Leviticus for how you two are worship God, guess what that is for? It's a type of what's going on in heaven. This is a resemblance of this. This mirrors this. It's a type. So what you're to do down here is you're to do it because this is what happens up here. It's a type of worship. It's showing you how worship is done, has always been done, and how you are to do it. Second of all, it prefigures Christ. In what ways? Well, his graces. So you have a sacrifice for atonement, right? What does that prefigure? It prefigures God's grace in Christ to become an atoning sacrifice for you. His actions. What actions? Well, take his cross. That's a sacrifice for sin. Yeah, that's a ceremonial thing, right? Jesus is obeying ceremonial law right there on the cross. And so the ceremonies of the Old Testament are prefiguring that work. His sufferings, his benefits, all these kinds of things.
In Leviticus, Exodus, different places, isn't there interchange moral and ceremonial laws scattered throughout there?
You mean civil and ceremonial laws?
Yeah.
There are, but there is a rhyme and a reason to the way that those books are written that can get really complicated. For the most part, Leviticus is ceremonial. For the most part, the civil of Exodus comes immediately after the Ten Commandments, and then the ceremonial begins once they start getting the instructions for the tabernacle. Deuteronomy is, for the most part, civil, not ceremonial. Okay? So there's coherence and rhyme and reason to what they're doing.
So I've wrestled, like probably a lot of us, with how would we and how should these civil laws pertain to or be imitated by nations now.
Right. I want to explore that, and we can keep going back to this after this class today. We can come back to this because it's a question we need to address, and I want to do that.
Right.
So let's keep going. So it says that all of these ceremonial laws that are typical and prefiguring Christ, they're appointed only to the time of Reformation. Now, that's language that comes from Hebrews, okay? The time of Reformation, that's basically the time of Christ's coming, all right? And are by Jesus and the only lawmaker who was furnished with the power from the Father for that end, abrogated and taken away. Now, this is the hard part of this. And I think I'm still confessional in this. I would argue that I am. You can read this as saying all ceremonial law has been abrogated and taken away. And some people have done that. I think that's holy nonsense, and I don't think that that's what the confession is teaching. It's saying that in its typical prefiguring usage of Christ, those laws no longer apply. So, for example, do we need to have a physical temple in Jerusalem that we walk into, offer animal sacrifices on? Is that a yes or no to that question?
No.
Why is that?
Christ.
Okay, because his sacrifice, was once for all. And as such, as those things typified what he did, they're abrogated. We don't need those anymore. Their function in that sense is gone. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
But the confession does not say that they are completely, in every sense, abrogated. So now let me give you some examples that I like to give to people. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Anybody know what that says?
Present your bodies as a living sacrifice.
Okay, let's stop right there. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Point one, sacrifices are ceremonial laws. Point two, Paul is telling you to offer your body as a living sacrifice. Therefore, the conclusion is, Paul is giving you a ceremonial law to follow in the New Testament. Therefore, all ceremonial law has not been abrogated. But something has been abrogated. Even there.
The temple that you walk to in Jerusalem on Mount Zion is not where you are to offer your body as living sacrifice. Where are you to do it?
In the world.
Everyday life. Why can you do that? Think temple. Think temple. The Spirit comes very close. Because we are the temple. You see that? So ceremonial law is necessary in the new covenant. It just takes a different outward form because the temple has changed. So this is why it talks about the prayers of the saints, going back to prayer, are as incense in Revelation. Incense? Well, where does that come from? That comes from ceremonial law of Leviticus. This is why Paul says that he was given the priestly duty of proclaiming the gospel to the Gentiles. Priestly duty? What are you talking about? I thought all ceremonial law has been abrogated and destroyed. No, it has changed the way that it looks because there has been a change in priesthood. And those priests now have different things that they're to do with their life. This is why baptism is such an important thing to understand to me. The priest, the Levite, when he was baptized, he then had to perform all of his work in the temple complex. When we are baptized, we perform our priestly work in the temple complex. Where's that? Well, it's two places. It's right here, and it's in my individual life. So you can find ceremonial law language all over the New Testament, just that we don't recognize it. Because we're not thinking like a Jew, like a priest, like we should be thinking. We're not recognizing the ceremonial language, and we're not understanding the continuity in the middle of discontinuity. Yep?
I have a question.
Okay.
This isn't like some heresy. Being raised that this ceremonial law stuff is totally gone away.
Right.
They hold to, it is all gone. And they often lose the sacrifice part.
Right.
Because of that. Now, my question is it wrong to assume that even that in itself, ceremony, is not gone for us as believers because we partake in communion and we're proclaiming that law continually?
Sure.
That would not be an error to believe.
No, I don't think so at all. And the living sacrifice, just for a point of note, that's like a thank offering. It's not, he's not talking about offer your body as an atoning sacrifice for your sin. There's different kinds of sacrifices in the Old Testament. Right. So you have to get the right sacrifice in your mind. It's a living sacrifice. It's like a free will offering, not like a burnt offering for sin. Right. OK, so that's something that is really important to understand. Now you can take this also with civil law. Right. So to the ceremonial law, sundry and judicial civil laws. Now, notice what it says again. Those expire together with the state of the people. In other words, the case law of Israel in civil law. All right. If your ox falls into a hole, there's certain rules that you have to follow. If a guy steals your ox, he's got to follow. You know, there's millions of these things. In those specific regulated ways of writing out the case law, those have been taken away. We are not obliged to the covenant that Israel had with their case law because we're not the nation of Israel like they were. But then look at the last part of it. The general equity only being of. Now, I like modern because that shows you that it's still civil law still applies. But moral is actually the right word there. Of moral use. What does that mean? Well, what that means is you go to the Ten Commandments, the second table, and you go, how am I supposed to apply this today? Well, give me a case. Give me something that happened that revolves around something like this. And then let's talk about it and let's come up with a solution to the problem, because every government that's ever lived has had to have civil law. The people have to. You have to have civil law. You cannot function without it. We're not under Israel's law. It wouldn't make any sense for me to be talking about cloaks and tunics and all this kind of stuff. I don't have those things. Right? I have a car. So I should probably make a civil law about cars that would be along the lines of principles that would fit the Ten Commandments.
Like if murder and stealing, I mean, you go to jail, you know, if you get caught.
Right.
How about the false witness? Does that fall in that same category? If you,
it should.
I agree with that, but I mean,
it used to a long time ago. These days, people are getting away with lying under oath all the time. But they will get caught, and they are supposed to be paying the penalty for it right now.
Okay?
So let me give you one example of a civil law that I think is super interesting that Paul does. He doesn't. This is not saying all civil law has been abrogated. It doesn't say that. It says that there is a moral use of the civil law. So guess what Paul does? He does this more than once. He takes this law of the do not muzzle the ox while it's treading the grain. And Paul doesn't say, well, that law doesn't apply anymore in any sense whatsoever because that's a civil law and we're not under the law anymore. Nope. He actually applies it today to the church. And what is his conclusion? You should pay your pastors. Now, I don't use that example because I want you to pay me. I'm just saying he's taking a very specific civil law and he's gathering the moral principle out of it and he's reapplying it in the church in a way that makes sense. Because civil law continues, ceremonial law continues, they don't continue in the same way as they did. Things have changed. There are differences, but there's also a lot more continuity here than a lot of people have ever even begun to imagine. And when you start thinking clearly about this, I think it can really help you understand the relationship of the Old Testament law to the New Testament law.
In the case of that, what Paul cited, it's obvious that he's talking about don't steal from your pastor. Hmm. Because another place he says a worker is worth
his wages. Right, exactly.
So if you don't pay him, you're stealing from him.
Yeah, so it's applying the moral law to a civil sort of an idea. Why would that be civil? You might say, well, that's ceremonial because the pastor is the priest and that's more like tithes or whatever. No. Civil, when you go to work, right? Those of you who have jobs in the world, what do you expect from your employer? Hopefully. Right? That's why you're working for him. So that's why I think he applies the civil law there instead of like a tithing law or something like that. Yeah.
Legislators and so forth from nations, they're obviously building laws from principles, as we just stated, aren't they? They're trying to inculcate moral civil law in their particular nation, and they write them out. Is it wrong for them to infer things and make laws in a nation?
I believe what's going on today, ideally, our law, and I believe it started this way, was being performed this way. We had the general Ten Commandments that everybody has, and we had it more specifically in this country than most nations ever have, because we had a bunch of God-fearing people that were powerful in politics. And our case law was being developed, I would say, in the general, on the Ten Commandments. I think what we're seeing today in the case law that's so crazy, wonky, wacky, is the case law is reflecting what people are trying to do here is rewrite those.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the case law is reflecting that. So what is Roe versus Wade? It's a rewriting of the law of murder. And even, you know, going back even farther than that to the image of God and those kinds of things. But that's why, this is what's going on today. We're rewriting the Ten Commandments in our own image and then creating case law to reflect that new law. The new moral law.
The security meeting we just had was dealing with self-defense. It was very interesting. And even we to defend ourselves, we need lawyers to defend our defending our, it's crazy, defending ourselves. And I'm like, why are they charging us with with any wrongdoing if we defend ourselves with weapons in our home and so forth. And I'm like, where are they getting this? Or where are they getting the right to defend ourselves? And it's in Exodus, which is really interesting.
And so you have to go to a case law of defending yourself in Exodus, and you have to ask, upon what principle is this case law being developed?
Right.
It's not just coming out of nowhere. It's coming out of the moral law of God, which itself comes out of a reflection of who He is and who He's created us as image bearers. All right?
Hair splitting. He talks about if you defend yourself in the dark, you're acquitted. But if you kill a thief in the light, you got an answer for it. It's very hairs. So it's really interesting. That's why we got all this fighting legally over defending ourselves. But it's there. The difference between if you shoot somebody in your house in the dark, or if it's the sun's out, you're gonna have scripture. I don't understand it, but I just want to throw it out.
People disagree about how to apply case law all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's something you can fight and argue about. But I hope that this is helpful for you, and we'll finish it up and then we'll go to the next chapter next week.
Okay.